And for the next 3 weeks, this week and the following 2 weeks, we're going to talk about controversies, doctrinal disputes, heresies that Augustine combated, sort of formed the core of his contribution to our theology was his response. How do we respond to these heresies? How do we articulate our Orthodox faith in a way that can meet the challenges of those who would oppose the church? And the controversy we're talking about this week is called Manichaeism. So to review a little bit from last week, Augustine was born in North Africa in the small town of Tagaste to a pagan father named Patricius or Patrick, who was like a small town aristocrat, and a devoted Christian mother named Monica. He was prepared for a legal career. His father desperately wanted him to be a lawyer, a rhetorician in the imperial service, so he went to school there in the small town of Tagaste, and his father scraped up enough money to send him to boarding school in the nearby town of Madaris, and eventually to University of Carthage, which is the largest town nearby, to study rhetoric. Augustine was the type of student who outstripped all his teachers, and while he was there in Carthage, he was sort of dissatisfied with the education he was receiving. In 373, he started reading Cicero's work, The Hortensius, which is about Platonism, and it really expanded his intellectual horizons, sort of set him out on a new path away from the law. And it was at that time he came to the Bible, and he read it seriously for the first time. He had been raised as a Christian by his mother, although not baptized, but he really hadn't read the Bible seriously as an intellectual work. And the first time he read it, he was very unimpressed with it, very dissatisfied. He found the language of it. The Bible at this time in North Africa was a very crude and rustic Latin. You might have heard of the church father Jerome, who translated the Latin Vulgate, which was the translation of choice throughout the Middle Ages. He hadn't translated the Bible yet, so he had a very sort of translation-ese, crude rendition of the Septuagint. And Augustine wasn't impressed with it. In response to that, he became what's called a Manichae hearer. Manichaeism, we're going to talk about it today, but it was a heresy. It was a Gnostic sect. And he was sort of at the lowest. He was like the entry level. He was a hearer, so he would go and listen to it and sort of partake in the discussions, but he wasn't one of the elect within the community. He wasn't sort of high on the path to enlightenment. Manichaeism, we're going to have to delve down into this heresy. It's sort of a long-lasting, important heresy, but kind of complex. That little fragment there is from Western China. This heresy lasted for 1,200 years. It started in the 3rd century AD, and it continued all the way until the 1400s. It was spread all the way from Britain in the west to China in the east. And this little fragment here is of a Chinese priest who was a Manichae. Gnosticism is a term that gets thrown around a lot. You may have heard of it in sort of contemporary debates. You might have heard of some of these non-biblical gospels. It comes from the word gnosis, which is the Greek for knowledge. Okay, same root word. The best way to think about this is from 1 Timothy 6:20, when Paul is cautioning Timothy to avoid knowledge falsely so-called, gnosis, falsely so-called. And Irenaeus is really the one who coins the term Gnosticism to describe this family of heresies. He's writing in the 2nd century about this group of heresies, and he calls it those who would falsely call themselves learned or Gnostics. Gnosticism, it's a big family of beliefs. It's not one single heresy. It's not one single person, but it's a whole cluster. Syncretic, which means it's a mixture, sort of a mixture of Christian elements, Eastern mysticism, and it's esoteric, meaning it's a secret knowledge. It's something that's not accessible to everyone. It's something you have to enter into and progress in. Generally, although there's a lot of belief systems within what we can call Gnosticism, there's four main things that tie it together. First of all, it's a rejection of the visible world as something that's alien to God. Matter is bad, spirit is higher, and matter is somehow evil. Second, that elect souls, the souls of those who truly understand, are divine sparks who've been imprisoned in the material world. So again, the spiritual world is sort of trapped and imprisoned in the material world. And you can see this in their attitudes towards things like marriage, to childbearing, to all sorts of worldly pleasures that are rejected in favor of a spiritual existence. Third common core belief is that Scripture has a hidden meaning. They might uphold the belief in Scripture, but it's really the hidden meaning of Scripture that's important, not the obvious meaning. And that hidden meaning is only available through secret wisdom. That's where the Gnosis comes in. And related to all these things, number four, that Christ only appeared to be human. He didn't really take on flesh. He didn't really die on the cross. He wasn't really a man. These were only ways that he appeared to us. And that's a heresy called docetism, which means to appear. It's really interesting. This is sort of similar to what Muslims believe about Christ, that he only appeared to die on the cross. He was really substituted for somebody else, or someone else was substituted for him at the last moment, because they can't accept that idea, that Christ really died on the cross. So some ways you might have heard of this popularly, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Judas, some of these apocryphal, non-biblical Gospels, non-canonical, that were written generally in the 2nd and 3rd century, so a lot later than our biblical Gospels. One of the most famous professors who writes about Gnosticism is Eileen Pagels at Princeton. She wrote a really famous book in the 70s called The Gnostic Gospels. So Manichaeism is part of this larger family called Gnosticism. Okay, Manichaeism originates with a Babylonian poet named Mani who lived in the 3rd century. It was an esoteric, ascetic, Gnostic sect, like a lot of Gnostics. It prided itself on rejecting worldly goods and pleasures, the lust of the flesh, marriage, childbearing, property owning, rejected all of this to live a spiritual existence to separate from the filth of the earthly world, the physical world. Like I said earlier, it spread all the way from Africa and Britain in the West to China, existed for 1,200 years. And it understood itself, at least in part, as a higher Christianity, not as an antithesis or a rejection of Christianity, but as the true and proper understanding of Christianity, the secret knowledge within the Bible that not everyone had. It was sort of the heresy par excellence. It was opposed by both pagans and Orthodox Christians. It was outlawed by the pagan Emperor Diocletian at the end of the 3rd century. So it was opposed by both Christians and pagans as being something very dangerous, something very disruptive. Augustine, he took up this belief system, started being a hearer in Carthage, and when he came back to Tagaste to become a teacher, his mother, who was very Orthodox, shut him out of the house entirely because he had become this heretic. And characteristically, she only let him back in the house after she had a dream in which God told her that he would reject this belief ultimately. And he writes about this in the Confessions. So, Manichaeism is a little bit confusing, but ultimately we have to delve into it and understand what they thought, because it's going to help us understand how Augustine responded to it and explain our beliefs about good and evil. So here's the myth. It's a very myth-driven belief system. And the central myth is that at the beginning of creation, there are two eternal opposing kingdoms, the kingdom of light and the kingdom of darkness, always and eternally in opposition. The kingdom of light is ruled by the king of greatness. The kingdom of darkness is ruled by the king of darkness. And the king of greatness is sort of this passive, more or less impotent force, and he's attacked out of jealousy by the king of darkness. And this sort of generates the creation myth. The father of greatness, he emanates a lesser god called the mother of life, who ultimately evokes the primal man. The primal man is defeated by the princes of darkness, who are sort of the agents of the king of darkness. And the light, which is their good nature, is devoured by them. And the construction of the world is ultimately undertaken to liberate this substance, this light, from the evil ones who have passed it on to all the material creatures that we see and who we are ourselves. So basically, the good that was the Father is sort of cast among all the creation of the world, trapped, and the world is a process of liberating those things. The elect are sort of liberating and collecting the good and trying to pass out of this life of sullied material. So, what is this? What are the principles behind this myth? What are they trying to get at? First of all, the most important principle is that of dualism. Dualism is the idea that good and evil are opposed, opposite forces, and eternally in opposition to each other. That might seem like something that the Bible teaches, it might seem like something that's sort of inherent in our idea about good and evil, but it's really not. And this is Augustine's most important contribution and why it's so important to study Manichaeism here. All right, related to that is their anti-materialism. Because they see the physical world as a prison for the good, it leads into a lot of ascetic conclusions about the way life should be lived. A rejection of worldly pleasure, employment, property. They're anti-marriage, anti-reproduction, anti-women in a lot of ways. They see the physical world as something to be escaped from, not as God's good creation, but as a prison for the soul. Thirdly, because they want to see God, the Father of greatness, is totally removed and totally separated from the evil world, the kingdom of darkness, God, the Father of greatness, has to be entirely passive. He doesn't have sovereignty. He doesn't rule his universe. He's passively waiting, and the Father of darkness is the one who's making all the actions, basically the cause of what all the evil that happens in the world. The Father himself, the Father of greatness, the good Father, is sitting back, and these things are happening to him. And fourthly, God is dependent on his creation. The good God here in this myth is dependent on his creation to sort of work out and recover the light that's been distributed amongst the creation. He's pressed upon by the evil one. The evil one's attacking him. He's in a state of weakness and dependency. And these are the things that really caused Augustine to have problems with this theology as he delved deeper into it and ultimately drove his response to it. Augustine's response to Manichaeism. This little picture here is from a medieval manuscript, but it purports to show Augustine there on the left with the halo and one of the leaders of the Manichaean community named Faustus on the right side. And this was a big dispute where Augustine finally got to talk to a man who was learned in Manichaeism and found his answers to be sorely lacking. And that's when Augustine finally rejected the belief system. So in 373 in Carthage, he becomes a Manichae hearer. He starts absorbing the theology, starts reading seriously into the texts. Like I said before, the African Latin Bible before Jerome was very stilted, and Augustine was very dissatisfied with it. Manichaeism allowed him to expand his intellectual horizons a bit wider. It also allowed him to be austere and spiritual and lofty, while at the same time not really rejecting that carnal lifestyle he'd had before. We talked about last week how he had taken up with a prostitute, a concubine, that he lived with for 15 years. And this sort of satisfied his idea that he could be a spiritual, austere man, but still live with that carnal lifestyle that he enjoyed before. It's important to note that Manichaeism gave Augustine a means to reject the God of the Old Testament, because the God of the Old Testament was very challenging to him. The idea that God would be vengeful, the idea that God would have anger, would have wrath, would sort of cause these apparently evil acts to come about. Also that the God of the Old Testament was portrayed carnally in a lot of ways, that he was portrayed as having human emotions, or that he created man in his image, sort of that God was said to have these attributes of a physical body. Also that sort of the gross sins of the patriarchs in the Old Testament, that they had multiple wives, that Moses committed murder, he could reject these and appeal to the higher reality of Manichaeism to sort of have a more pure story. Eventually, as Augustine studies, he's far more talented than his teachers, and he surpasses them. And every time he comes up with a question about how this system is apparently deficient, he's told to wait for Faustus, who's sort of the leader. He's the top party chief. And he's told to wait for Faustus to come, and he'll answer his questions. So eventually Faustus does come to Carthage, and Augustine is able to talk with him. And he's deeply dissatisfied once again with what he finds. He says, "I found at once that the man was not learned in any of the liberal studies save literature, and not especially learned in that either." And Faustus actually asked Augustine to be his teacher and to teach him more. So Augustine here, he's totally dissatisfied. His hopes and dreams for this system as being a complete system are shattered. And Augustine ultimately departs Carthage for Rome in 383, and he's seeking something higher, which will eventually lead him to Christ. Later on, after he's become a bishop, he's come back to Orthodoxy. He writes the Contra Faustum, which means against Faustus, and it's the definitive rejection of Manichaean doctrine. So what does Augustine say? How does he oppose this doctrine? How does he articulate our beliefs about it? The first and most important thing is that he rejects dualism. Good and evil in our belief system are not eternally opposed. God's sovereignty is upheld. God has decreed all that is and all that will be. That's the first and most important foundation. And I've set aside these couple of texts because I think they're important to articulate some of the apparent complexity in the Old Testament and also how we have to see God's sovereignty and a lot of these events that it would seem that God is allowing or permitting evil in the world. So Jeremiah 25:9, God says, Jeremiah says, as a prophet of God, "Behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith the Lord, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land, and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about, and will utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment, and a hissing, and perpetual desolations." God calls the king of Babylon his servant. He says that he controls the agents of destruction. In Job chapter 1, verse 12, God speaks to Satan. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth in the presence of the Lord. That the Lord controls Satan. Satan is not an eternal opposition to God, but everything that Satan does, God has allowed and decreed that he would do. Isaiah 54:16. Behold, I have created the smith that bloweth the coals in the fire, and that bringeth forth an instrument for his work, and I have created the waster to destroy. That God has created Satan, God controls Satan, and everything that happens in the world is decreed by God. So how can we describe evil? If evil is not an eternal coexistent force that opposes good, what is it? How do we understand it? How does an eternally good and eternally powerful God coexist with a world in which evil is obviously present and is a continuous theme throughout the scriptures? And here's Augustine's greatest contribution to our understanding of evil. He talks about the somewhat complex idea of the insubstantiality of evil. And it's something we have to delve in, although it's a little bit complicated, and I think it's something that's personally profitable for me. I think about it a lot when I'm trying to understand what's going on in the world. Here in Confessions, Augustine gives a description of what he means. He says, So then, if things are deprived of all good, they will be nothing at all. Therefore, as long as they exist, they are good. Accordingly, whatever things exist are good, and the evil into whose origins I was inquiring is not a substance. For if it were a substance, it would be good. Hence I saw, and it was made clear to me, that you made all things good, and there are absolutely no substances which you did not make. So what he's trying to say here is that evil is not a substance that's competing with good. It's a substance. It doesn't have any being in itself. Evil is only a corruption of the created good that God made. When God made all things good, that was all that there was. Evil is a corruption or a breaking down or a deprivation of that which God has created originally. Okay, so evil is a corruption. It's not an alternative reality. Whereas the Manichaeans saw good and evil as two opposing forces, there's only the good that God has created, and then through the fall of man, that good has been corrupted and broken down. So that's what we see now. When we see something that's an evil action, it's actually a deprivation of what God has created. And this is really a useful way to think about it, because we think about turning God's good gifts into evil ways. It's really about a privation. It's not about Satan as this other king of darkness who's opposed to God, who God can't control. No, it's within God's creation. It's a breaking down. I like to think about it through the analogy of hot and cold. Sometimes you think of like the bath that has two taps, one's a hot one, one's a cold one. These are two opposing things. But physicists will tell you that's not really the way it is. Heat is the only principle there is. Cold is just less heat. That's the reality of good and evil. There's good, the fullness of good, which is God, and then his created reality, which is us. The cold is that what we think of as evil, that decrease, that diminishment of what God has originally created. To me, this gives us a perspective to profit from and appreciate God's good, even in the midst of corruption, because it tells us that wherever good is found, that belongs to God. If you can think about false religions like the belief system of Islam, they uphold some things within their system that are true and that are good, like the belief in one single God. They reject multiple gods. And that's a reality of God's truth. But the falsehood of it, their entire belief system that's built around that, is the corruption and privation of that truth, that full understanding of God. It also allows us to appreciate the gifts of unbelievers, how someone who's opposed to God can still enjoy his good gift. That goodness is something that's been provided by God. And the wickedness that surrounds it is a privation of his gift. I really like this quotation from Rowan Williams, who is a former Archbishop of the Church of England, although I don't agree with all his theology, but this makes a lot of sense to me. God maintains this radical independence from his creation because he's not in any way needful of it. He doesn't depend upon it to restore him to anything, and nothing it does can harm him or benefit him. So Rowan Williams says, Thus creation really is good for nothing. Its point is not to serve a divine need. Our difficulty with the idea is, depressingly, the difficulty of imagining a need-free love. And it is a difficulty felt as much by ancients as by moderns. Meaning that, unlike in the myth of Manichaeism, the God of the Bible doesn't need his creation in any way. He's not in any way dependent upon us, nor can we harm him in any way. He's totally separated from us, and he created us out of a need-free love. He doesn't have any end or any means in our creation. That's something that's difficult to understand because it's unlike any of our relationships with anyone else or anything else in the world. So, Since God is entirely good and evil is not substantial, how did evil come about in the first place? We have an entirely good God, an entirely powerful God, and yet we have the existence of evil in the world. Augustine's answer, first of all, is to reinforce what we just said, that we don't really, evil in the world is not an effect, it's a defect. That's a hard concept to understand, but it's not a cause itself, it's not a reality itself, it's a corruption of God's reality. So to look for the cause of defection is as if someone wished to see darkness or to hear silence. So Augustine, he doesn't answer an absolute clear answer about how and why the first sin came into the world through Adam, but he offers this. This I do know, that the nature of God cannot be deficient at any time, anywhere, in any respect, while things which are made from nothing are capable of deficiency. So the fall, although it's complex, how Adam could have first sinned, could have first fallen away from his fully good created nature, but it's integrally related to man's creation from nothing, that man had the capability to fall because he was created out of nothing, first of all. So to summarize some of Augustine's points here, this is a little depiction of Augustine battling the heretics from the Middle Ages. First of all, we can remember that Augustine opposes the doctrine of dualism. He would emphasize that all that is good. God created all things. He called them all very good. Everything evil itself is not something that started at the beginning. It's not something that has any reality on its own. It's simply a diminishment, a destruction, a corruption of God's own reality. Secondly, he validates the original goodness of the physical creation. This is something very important, and I think Augustine is unfairly criticized a lot in modern theology for being himself a dualist or being somehow ascetic. He was celibate after he left his concubine. He was very strict about continence and self-control in a way that people in our time would find somewhat discomforting. But he upheld physical creation as something that was truly good. This is crucial to Christ's incarnation, because the physical reality is something that is somehow dirty. It's very hard for us to worship Jesus Christ who came in the flesh. So by validating physical creation, he's also validating the reality of Christ, that Christ really did come as a man. He really did live in the flesh. He really did eat, breathe, and drink, and he really did die on the cross. Second, that he upholds marriage. He upholds childbearing, which was sort of, believe it or not, controversial in that time. A lot of people, because of their emphasis on spirituality, felt that marriage and childbearing was something that was dirty and had to be avoided. Thirdly, he upholds God's sovereignty. And ultimately, we're going to talk about next week, Augustine and Pelagianism. Augustine is sort of the greatest defender of God's sovereignty, his control over all the affairs of man. God creates the world out of nothing, not out of some formless matter that pre-existed, not something that was sort of coexistent with him. There is only God, and then God creates the world out of nothing. And everything in the world has a dependence on God for its entire existence, for its sustainment, and God has no dependence whatsoever upon the world. So God is entirely distinct from his creation. And these are the three ways that Augustine contributes to our modern thought about what the Bible says, what evil is, what the creation is, through his refutation of Manichaeism. I'd be happy to take any questions that you have now. Yes, please. Focus on the elect, who in this life they're becoming, they're sort of growing in their spiritual path, and will eventually pass out of the physical realm, become purely spirits. Yes, they'll sort of be restored to the Father of greatness. They'll sort of leave behind their physical bonds. The word tabernacle of the flesh is used a lot. The people are, they're sort of trapped in the bondage of the flesh, and they'll ultimately have a higher reality of existing only in spirit in a future life. Right, well, I think that's one really important lesson we can draw out of this, because it's really easy to paint that picture, because evil is such an important concept in the scriptures to paint here as the. And you sort of see that in like cartoonish versions of Christianity, that it's God versus Satan in some way. And that's not at all what the scriptures teach. The scriptures teach that God's in control of Satan, that Satan's on a leash and he doesn't go any further than God lets him go. That, like we read in these verses of scripture, God uses the evil purposes, the evil men who would do evil things in the world are still being used by God to accomplish what he wants to for the good of those who follow him in the world. That's the biblical reality.
You had made a statement when you were describing Gnosticism, and so today want to use it as such?
Yeah, I can't say I've really read too deeply into Gnosticism, I don't find it that profitable to go back and read apocryphal gospels and things like that. As you can see why, it's a very complex system on its own. It's hard. I mean, it's hard to say. I think in the Gnostic Gospels, they do have females having a more prominent role, like in the salvation story, Christ having a wife and things of that nature. But as to why modern feminists find it to be more appealing, it's kind of, I don't know. I don't have an answer for you. Sorry.
I have an answer to your question.
Yes, please.
What was the term you used last week for Augustine's father when he was being interested in?
Catechumen. Catechumen. That's someone who's undergoing catechesis. There's almost no evidence of Gnosticism existing. There is no evidence of Gnosticism existing before Christ. So, scholarship now thinks it's only arises after Christ. The Christian element is a common element, although it can be peripheral to Gnostic beliefs. They've all incorporated that Christian element, and they see themselves as Christian, or as a higher version of Christianity. Yes. I think all heresies can be seen as... Heresy has been described as taking a truth of God and taking it too far to where it becomes a lie. Not one individual. You hear the early church talk about Simon Magus as the sort of father of heresy, that he was like the origin of all heresies, but it's just sort of a traditional... story. Gnosticism was a big family of beliefs, so you have a lot of different kinds and subtypes within that family. Did you have one question? They were completely celibate. At least the higher ones. The hearers were sort of more carnal, but those who were higher on the path were completely celibate. And I think women would be definitely associated with the carnality of the flesh a lot more because of their role in childbearing. So we don't hear about women being involved at the higher levels. But it wasn't a religion that had a great social prominence. It was always sort of outcast. So they weren't like in a policy making position. They were sort of hated universally by pagans and by Christians. Sir? 1400s, it was really just existing in China. I'm not an expert in Chinese history, so I can't tell you the sort of social forces that were at work there. But within the West, it was expunged as like a continuous force. It would pop up every now and again in the Middle Ages, people coming up with this sort of rediscovering the heresy. The sort of a tendency of heresies in the church is they don't have like a continuous lifespan as like an alternate church. They sort of pop up when someone thinks they have this very ingenious idea. And they go away and they pop up again, like we see with all sorts of beliefs today about the Trinity. So it popped up a few times throughout the Middle Ages, but really it was sort of extinguished during this time in the early church.
Did other Chinese religions like Taoism spring forth or something like this?
Not from it, although you see that it's sort of tied into Buddhism. It's a syncretic religion, meaning a mixture religion. So as it moves into other places, it would mix with Zoroastrianism in Persia, it would mix with Buddhism, sort of incorporate elements to popularize itself.
Stephen, how would you, if somebody were going to pick up the City of God up there on the table and want to get a little bit, maybe a handle on Augustine's, the basic theme, would you recommend that they just start with book one, read all the way through, or do you have recommend a different approach?
I recommend starting with the Confessions. Start with the Confessions if you want to read something by Augustine, because it's very readable. It's not... This talk's a little bit complex, I realize that, but the Confessions is very readable, it's very personal. It's Augustine talking about his personal faith in God, his personal faith journey, sort of biographical. It's a great place to start because it's very approachable. City of God is obviously, it's about that thick, so it's going to take some wading through, but it's also, it's not hard to read, it's just, it's very long. So once you read through the Confessions, you understand where Augustine's coming from. If you want to read a little bit about the City of God, has a little more Roman history in it, has a little bit more philosophy in it, and that's a good place to go after that. Yes, sir? Well, that's a big question. Ties back to why the fall happened in the first place, which is not something there's a simple answer to. I think, is it Calvin who says that man has a God-shaped hole in his heart? And he says that man's heart is a factory of idols. Definitely. And he puts anything into that hole to fill it, other than God. So the history of mankind is a history of idol worship and idol creation. It still is now. I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer for you, but... I think probably yes. Like, he was a monk. He founded an order of monks. I mean, he was a bishop, but he was also completely celibate. He thought rejecting marriage was a higher path. It wasn't marriage itself wasn't invalid, but like many Catholics would hold now, that rejecting marriage was something that allowed him to be closer to God. Vegetarian for some of the same reasons. Catholicism in this early time in the church means something different than it means today. The See of Rome didn't mean the same thing as it means today. But there were still elements of his ecclesiology that we'd be very uncomfortable with. After all, he was a bishop. So as Presbyterians, yes, there's some elements of that that we would take issue with. But I think...
But we still are appreciative to him for...
Absolutely. I think to focus on some of those smaller issues, to lose sight of the great contributions he had that sort of make us understand what it is to be a Christian and what... God's sovereignty, what predestination means. If we lose sight of that because of some of these smaller decisions he had, smaller loyalties he had, I think we'd be really missing out on a great treasure of the church. Yes, sir. I think we just don't want to put ourselves in a position of reinventing the wheel as Christians or feeling like we're the first ones to ever approach the Bible, because it's too much. We have a community that God has given us in the church, and for us to approach it as if we're the first ones to read the Word or the first ones to think of the ideas is going to be overwhelming, and we're not going to make progress. We're not going to sort of stand on the shoulders that they, of the work that they already did and benefit from it. I think God has put them in our paths and in our lives for a reason.
Interesting. Along the lines of what Karen asked, you know, when we read the story of Luther and kind of
I think it's important to remember the sort of intellectual climate, culture that you're dealing with at this time. Most people are illiterate. You got to remember that. They're receiving their instruction through the service of the Mass, the early Mass at that time, through the sacraments, through homilies, through the sermons that were preached on a weekly basis. They can't read these great texts, so they're really absorbing it through sort of a more basic teachings that Augustine is putting out and other pastors, other priests and bishops are putting out through their sermons. I think what you're seeing on a higher level is not what the common people were seeing on a lower level. There was a tendency in the early church, it's important to recognize, to separate between sort of the spiritual elite and the common folk, not in the way that Manichaeists did it, not as if they were on a higher path, but that those who would separate themselves from the world, like monks and nuns, which is sort of taking off in popularity at this time, were the ones doing the spiritual heavy lifting in the world, and the common people could live more carnal lives, marriage, children, work in the world, enjoy their pleasures, simply attend the services and check the blocks, and sort of worry that they could think the saints on the other side of the house were taking care of the spiritual heavy lifting, and that would that would make sure that they were good. So you see some of those early problems with Catholicism developing at this time already. And it is Augustine to blame for some of that because he's sort of pushing the spiritual elite? Maybe so. Maybe so.